Quick question for you. What's a product that you think way more designers should be using? I know my answer, hands down, it is Raycast. It's like my shortcut to everything on my computer. It's how I interface with AI, how I organize my desktop, how I find the right emoji. It's even how I search for my Figma files. The more that I use Raycast, the easier it is to stay in flow while I work. And that's why I'm constantly recommending it to designers. So if you're not using Raycast yet, head to dive.club/Raycast to learn more. That's R-A-Y-C-A-S-T. Okay, now onto the episode.
You just look in a screen or like in a website, in a product, and anything they've done, you just look for that, like for two or three details. Where have they truly done something that they wouldn't have had to do? When no one asked them to do this, and they did it because they thought it would add a little bit more soul to the thing they were designing. And the moment you find someone that did that once or twice or three times across different projects, it's a very high likelihood that they will succeed.
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. Today, I'm talking with Dennis Mueller, who's the founder and designer of a new calendar product called Amy. Now, there's a pretty good chance that you've been on their website, and if you have, then you know that everything they do is the highest quality. So this is a conversation about craft, product strategy, hiring, and how to tie it all together as a design founder. So let's start by going all the way back to the beginning and hearing from Dennis why he first started Amy.
I was very obsessed with habits and habit building, and I decided to quit my job. And before that already, I already started to like toy with some ideas, some prototypes, all in the habit building space. I think the initial ambition was actually quite humble. I just thought maybe I could make it to 10K MRR myself. And that was really the simple starting point. And as I dove into all of those explorations and a few different products, I realized that the real way to like build habits and help people achieve difficult goals lies in the calendar. So I think many people come at the calendar from a very tactical perspective of like it's a work tool, etc. And I think you can also see in Amy that we have always taken a very personal approach, mainly because the starting point was already personal, was habits. It was like the calendar is the best way to visualize the things that you do. Most habit trackers are super separate from anything else. You can just hit, I did it, I did it, I did it, and it shows you some statistics. And I was like, the calendar is sort of what Google Maps is for getting from A to B. Like Google Maps tells you like, you know, take a left turn, go straight, etc. And the calendar can be the same for your goals. If you want to achieve something, you can use it as a map, as like, how do I get to my goal? It's never been about like, oh, how can we build a calendar that is best suited for teams? It was always really about like, how can we help people achieve their goals, deal better with their time?
I want to start by talking about product strategy a little bit, because there's a lot of typical advice that you would see given to startups. And it's very much so, you know, it revolves around this idea of the MVP. And we toss around these phrases like, you know, if you're not embarrassed by the first version of your product, then you waited too long. And on the outside, a lot of what you are doing and how you are approaching Amy kind of feels a little bit like the opposite of that, where you launched after years and you did so with excellence and a couple of really high production quality launch videos as well. So can you talk to us about how you think about the product and the go-to-market strategy for something like Amy?
I was still embarrassed of the launch. So in that sense, I don't think we waited too long. I think everybody has a different embarrassment level. I think our launches were always very well perceived. But going back, I would do a ton of things different. But it's always very easy in hindsight, right? We took a lot of sidetracks. We explored a lot of social components that I think, honestly, like at this point, are not even in the product anymore because they just didn't stick. We had a lot of high expectations. We saw the usage and then realized, we are not going to invest any further. Let's drop it. We did a ton of this stuff. I think that the important question to ask is now, how long would it take to do the same that we did with all the knowledge? And I think that timeline is somewhere between 12 to 18 months. We'd be able to compress 4 years into 18 months. And that is just an expression of how much I had to learn, like how many mistakes I made. But I think the good thing is that you usually don't have to get too many things right. Like if you get two or three really big things right, all of the mistakes are just irrelevant. Because I think with the launch that we did in the end of January, that is the moment where like the company also like transforms, where you have to be a lot more serious. Where like I think for us the prioritization shifts a little bit, and where things are changing. there's always points in time where every company has to go through like a maturing phase. And we're hitting that right now.
Can you talk about that maturing phase? Like, what are some of the before and after differences once you've crossed that official January launch line?
We were like, I mean, very ignorant when it came to timelines, or oblivious nearly, like as if timelines don't exist. We build things very much free flowing. We spend a lot of time on design. I think it's evident. We iterated a ton. We've like scrapped things that ultimately I think got marginally better. Like they got better, but not 10x or like, you know, even 5x. And now we are just more conscious of time. We realize, you know, we have to build up revenue. For like 3.75 years of the four, we never really considered like how will we monetize this product. We did, but like there is a difference between thinking about it and shipping it, getting the feedback, iterating, etc. So we are really, really like kind of conscious of that right now. I think we are avoiding all of those excuses that you can find like, oh, no, it's all about engagement. It's all about engagement. Yeah, that is true. In an environment where VCs, you know, will fund anything forever. I think we are just realistic. And I think the advice that many founders give each other these days is that just expect no one to ever fund you again. You just got to build a company that stands on its own, that can grow on its own. And those things are just not something that I've considered a lot before. Because when you make €0 or $0 MRR, you have no relation for nothing. Like you can't measure things in MRR because it's not zero. But the moment you have at least some MRR, like let's say $1,000 or like 10,000, whatever, everything you do is measured against that. So I think in that sense, we stop looking for excuses. Even a waitlist is in many ways just an excuse. Like you're just excusing bad metrics and like you put like a wall in front so you can always tell yourself a story. And we did that for a long time and many other founders do for a long time. But in fact, you're better off having no waitlist after like, as long as it's like somewhat usable, because then you're going to like really like face reality a lot faster.
You talked about the amount of iterations that you're doing. And I've kind of personally been curious about that because as like a design founder that's owning pretty much all of the design, like it almost feels like you can iterate forever. And there's one instance that I'm kind of interested in hearing a little bit more about, which is this redesign from your alpha to your beta, because it's like a really massive visual overhaul. And yet I looked at screenshots of the alpha and like, it's legit. Like I think 99% of designers would be very proud of that work. So can you talk a little bit about like what informed that change? And then also like, how is it reflective of the way that you work as a design founder?
Most designs on a static mockup look fine. Like it's actually quite hard to get them wrong on a static mockup. But the moment you use them, especially when you build a product that people use 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 times a day, every little friction point, every little inconvenience, every little question mark compounds times 50. And in fact, it doesn't compound that much because like after 10 times, you are just out. So I think we've hit reality and realized that, oh, the initial alpha design was a lot too simplistic. Then we made it a bit more complex. Then we made it too complex. So we made it a bit easier again. And then we kept on iterating. And I think it was like largely just informed by usage and the nuances of usage. And we have one of the best ways to collect feedback. Like we have so much feedback, it's insane. And we all reread it, respond to virtually all of it. Every time like two or three people bring up the same problem, we iterate. And then next time it's just like, now it's two people complaining. So like at least it got a little bit better. And I think that is probably the reality of tools, especially like those daily use tools, that it's incredibly difficult to make, I mean, it's not like make everyone happy, but those patterns, those like these small nuances of like how drag and drop works and how like the right click menus, people don't really know them. There's like a ton of those like small interaction details. We were always quite motivated by making it special, by giving it like a special twist. And I think that has like, that is another multiplier. Like it's already difficult to get it right. And when you then try to make things different, it goes crazy. Actually, some of the most popular apps are not even that innovative, like UI, UX-wise. They may look nicer, but you can oftentimes find an equivalent, like an old equivalent, like Things, you know, Things 3. Like a lot of apps that now are very beloved, effectively like are just a remix of Things 3, which like they have gotten virtually all of the small details right.
How do you think about that balance then? Like the right places to capitalize on what you know works versus finding little ways to innovate and bring something new to market?
I think it comes a lot more like now with the maturing process, we're leaning a lot more towards bringing what works to the market. We often, like not often, but like sometimes try to brute force our way to like, you know, no, like this just needs more iteration. And many times this is true. Many times you're just iterations away from success. But other times you just, you know, no amount of iteration will get you there. The more time passes and the more we mature, quote unquote, the more often we just, you know, admit and, you know, realize, okay, we probably don't have the patience for like to make this work. Let's move on to things that will work. Because we shipped a few smaller things that are like, they are pretty much what is out there in other tools, other apps, but it has our twist. And we see that this also works really well. And I think there is like linear, I think is that to me. I don't think there is anything particularly innovative about it. It's very fast, it's very performant, and like it just takes what works and gives it like a slightly opinionated taste. Evidently, they're very successful with that. So I think that is one really good strategy that we don't do like to like a full extent, but we are leaning more into it than before.
Is there an example that you can share of a time where maybe you were trying to brute force something and ended up going a different direction?
One time where we brute force things was like the social component. At the essence, it will still happen. I'm 100% like zero doubt that like there is a, that the calendar is in some way an inherently social app. I think, in fact, it's not really like a controversial statement, but the way we did it of like kind of a personal CRM and like taking notes on people and like we were like already thinking 4 or 5 steps ahead of like, oh, like we looked at these like LinkedIn bio pages and we were like, wow, if we have a cool profile where you can even book time, where you can like leave your some of your personal details, it had like a nice little bento type design. We were like, wow, the only thing left to do is build a button so you can publicize your profile and people will use it, link in bio. Some people are like so disciplined with sequencing. They like just know what comes first, second, third, fourth, fifth. And I think I oftentimes got ahead of myself for Amy and was like, let's do 5, 3, 1, 2, you know, whatever number I forgot. And I think it's funny, you know, like, cause like you, oftentimes the reward is only in 4 and 5. And that's when like your product gets really exciting suddenly.
Let's talk a little bit more about that then, because there's like a couple features that really stand out to me that are not obvious that you have done to stand out and almost create your own type of feature comparison with similar products in the market. One is showing what music you're listening to, and the other is the health data, where I would imagine, you know, you talked about this feedback process. I would imagine that you probably didn't have people banging on the door saying, please show my health data on my calendar. Can you talk a little bit about why that was something that you prioritized and maybe even like, yeah, how that's reflected in this idea that you were talking about of saying like, you know, I'm just excited about this. Like, I believe that this needs to exist, even if it's not solving a direct pain point that people are coming to me with.
And our prioritization defense. Both of those things were built during hackathons. And like how we think about them is, how many products do you know that are very well established, that are like, you know, have hit product market fit, if you know, want to call it that way, and that then add something like this? I guess the number is like, you know, approaches zero. Because yeah. At some point, you just became so mature. This product market fit process maybe humbles you to such a degree where you like really like learn what is important, what isn't. That is like the one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is maybe like you become too greedy and like everything has to have an immediate payoff. And I think Spotify and the health integration, and especially the sleep one, I think it's super cool. It takes a concept that people have been doing before, this quantified self, this whole idea around it, which is super tedious. But we, I think, made one little part of it very easy. And I think it's just cool. It's super cool. I think seeing my workouts, my runs in there, super nice. And I mean, yeah, sure. In the future, maybe we can help you correlate some data. But I think that is stuff like this usually doesn't happen, to be realistic. And so until then, I think it's a gimmicky feature for sure. But people just love fun things. Like, I'm not sure this is like very controversial either, but most people just don't make fun things.
I mean, your point about the life cycle of company and what that allows for in terms of the design decisions that you're making totally resonates. And what you just said, like, put a smile on my face. You're just like, it's just cool. Yeah. Like, I think it's just cool. And maybe that is not enough justification for this large established company where everything trickles down to numbers at the end of the day, where you still have some space to design for vibes. And I think that that is reflected in how the product feels, as you know, and I'm talking as someone who uses it every day. I do want to talk about like that tension between vibes and more research responding to feedback, because you did mention that you had a feedback process that you're pretty proud of. So maybe can you shine a light on what that looks like? And then, how you are balancing responding to that type of feedback versus trusting your own taste and intuition.
It's very difficult. I think we used taste and intuition for virtually everything, which we rolled back on quite a bit. So, I mean, maybe another story. I never kind of badmouth any product. So like, I will not name the name, but there is a product we used, which is incredibly opinionated. You just cannot make it work like you want. It only works like it wants. And everybody talks so highly about opinionation. I got to like come around of like, man, I actually hate this product. I never want to use this again. That is the worst end of taste and intuition. Like, you've built something that like at some point, like it only works for you. Like, it works for no one else. And I think we did that too in many ways. Like, we initially thought of building purposely less. And I think now I've like changed my mind on that a little bit, where I'm like, actually, no. Like, if you build a tool, like, you need to satisfy the needs. They will never give you the chance to like try all of those fun, cool, new, innovative features that you're building. You need to first earn the right to be their default calendar to do email app. And then you can give them all sorts of other things. So I think now we've come a lot more to like a, you know, strategy, quote unquote, that is a lot more like maximalist, but that, you know, we try to sort of tame the maximalism. We still don't build everything, any small thing people ask for. And I think we still keep it somewhat contained, but we are like now like a lot more willing to build things we never thought we would. And I think an example was like priority. Like, to-do priorities are a thing, you know, of like, I mean, must be 20 years old feature. And we were like really like strongly against it. We were just like, oh, no, man. And this just like adds one more button to every to-do, and we didn't want to do it. And then we realized like for another feature, we have to have it for it to make sense. But then we went in and said like, okay, what sucks about priorities? Usually you have like none, low, medium, high. And some tools even offer you some sort of like extremely high. And then we were like, wow, that is a lot of thinking to do for like, you know, one small, like one task that you have to do, like, you know, takes like an hour. So what we did is that we said, okay, it's binary. You can have no priority or you can make a priority. And then I think a fun twist comes in. You can also have super priority, but you can only have three. You can't go in and make everything a super priority.
So you said something that I want to double click on, which is this idea of taming the maximalism, which I think is so important in the type of product you're building, where you have the potential for a very large surface area because of this kind of all-in-one vision where you're doing to-dos and email and calendar in one product. So how do you translate that idea, tame the maximalism, into like concrete UI decisions? What does that look like?
The taming part, I guess, is like finding good UI that hides everything. If you just look at the surface, at the product, there is actually not that many buttons and not many knobs and not many options and not many things. And I think that is we're pretty happy about that. However, like if you hover one to do, actually there is, I think, three buttons get exposed, but only if you hover that one. We nest more than maybe other apps, which comes at a detriment. Some apps don't nest anything. Like there's a dropdown, and in that dropdown, you will get 200 options. And what we will usually do is like we have a dropdown and then like there's like sub options, and then you can like, usually you can go one or two levels in. Comes with a downside. Huh? Like, so whenever you need to switch a calendar and Amy, it just takes more time than it would take elsewhere. Sometimes I'm really happy with that because it's not that common of a workflow. Most people just rarely switch the calendar of a specific event. So for them, it's actually beneficial that we gave it like a very small button, not very prominent, but it's challenging. Like we have, you know, taste and intuition, but we, you know, we have this rule of like just like a sort of rule of thumb. If like two or three people bring it up, we usually go back to something else, or we at least keep iterating. We just take it as a signal. Like if three people ask, it's just a signal that we didn't get it right. And like three is a very low number, like you might ask, like, because we have like, you know, so many users, but you know, you just gotta understand that most people never ever give feedback on anything. The only feedback they ever give is very binary. The feedback they give is I'm out or I'm in. And that is the whole feedback they will provide you with. But every time just one person expresses a problem very concisely, we oftentimes, just based off one feedback, we'll redo everything, or like we'll redo a whole component or something, because it takes out of like 1,000 people that like maybe just one person is even able to express it this concisely, this precisely. And so whenever someone does that, we know, okay, there is something here, and there is just hundreds or thousands of users who thought the same, but just weren't able to express it as precisely. And so, yeah, we just wait for a very low N to iterate on things. But until, so like, that's why, like, many things that we don't get much feedback on are just the way they are because we did them the way we wanted to, and that's fine. There is also some things like we have this, the way events pop up from the bottom. I think in retrospect, we probably got like maybe 30 to 50 comments on this not being great. But there we were like, okay, like this, there we, our taste or intuition superseded the feedbacks because we were like, okay, yes, I get it. Or we get it. You really prefer the old way that we had or that other apps have. But we think it's actually, it's very beneficial. It may have new problems, but at least you exactly know where it pops up. I think other products have solved it with a sidebar. The reason we didn't do a sidebar is because, like, it's like burger menus. Like, you know, when you have a burger menu, this gives you permission, quote unquote, to just stuff it with like all sorts of like navigation. Whenever people have a burger menu that has like the whole navigation inside of it, or even when people have a bottom tab bar, I always think it's an expression of one of two things. Typically, they have zero product strategy. They just say, okay, we take like four or five common places, we put them here. Or they also never really looked into how to navigate their product. They just say like, yeah, it's fine if everything's a page. I think if you look at our iOS app, it's actually very fluid, mainly because there is no real pagination. I think the only real page we have is the settings page. The rest is like more free flowing, more like, you know, expands and collapses from somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, totally. It just feels like one kind of connected experience where things are flying in and out based off of the actions that I take. I want to zoom out a little bit and talk about team building for a second, because you have this vision. I'd like to hear how you thought about the type of org that you would have to create in order to execute against this vision. And maybe we can even start with a little bit of like a higher level. Like, what were some of the traits or backgrounds that you were looking for in early candidates that made you say like, yes, like I have to have this person on the team?
When we started out, I had a lot of thoughts of like on hiring, and we, you know, we went this way and we struggled to find people because, of course, the more specific you are, the longer it takes usually. And then we shifted and became more, a bit more like broad, a bit more generic. We made compromises, and now we are more or less where we started out. The mental lesson maybe here is you should probably trust your gut a little bit more often. I think it's midwit behavior to sort of analyze everything till death and like kind of do what big companies do. Because, like, you know, to answer your question now, back in the days, like, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, Notion still had this role of like designer who codes. That was the exact expression, designer who codes. I was very impressed, and like I did some research. I talked to some, like, one person who was a designer who codes at Notion, you know, way many years ago. And in fact, we initially called it designer who codes. It's not really like a catchy title, but it gets the point across. And then at some point, we just sort of gave up on it a little bit, and we're like, huh? No, I mean, like a regular product designer will also do a lot of the magic that happens inside our desktop or web or desktop based product is because, like, Stefan, our design engineer, so now there's a catchier title for it, has a very singular vision. And I think we found a fantastic collaboration in which he can execute on the singular vision. He has it, like, he kind of has like ideas where we can go. And like, that's something I wish we had done more of, just stay true. And I think because that's where like these small teams can win, is because the founders just stay very clear to like what they want to have in the team. They don't budge, they don't kind of make any compromises. And then you can build massive things with small people if like everything is well tuned. I know like that your audience is probably a lot more US based than Europe based. So I'm going to talk about what we call football. So like soccer. Like, I think there is a spectrum of like coaches. There is like Pep Guardiola, coach of Manchester City. And then there is Carlo Ancelotti, coach of Real Madrid. And I think they sort of form the spectrum. Carlo Ancelotti is known to be very hands-off, kind of just let the players play. He's very flexible with formation. Pep Guardiola, on the other hand, tells everybody exactly what to do, looks for the exact players to fit into his squad. He builds a squad very kind of consciously versus Ancelotti, who kind of builds a system around the squad and then expands the squad a little bit. Clearly, like Guardiola is a pain in the ass to work with, like a huge pain. Every person building a team has to decide where on the spectrum do they fall. Please do not pick the middle. That's like your company is going to fail if you're in the middle. I think both work. And I think that's where like in tech, there has been this prevalent opinion that you need to like hire great people and then empower them to do great work. Yes, that works. It's one side of the spectrum. It's the Real Madrid, Ancelotti type of thing. Over the last 10 years, it has become a lot less popular to run a team or like a company like Guardiola, like a very tight ship, micromanage, tell people what to do, tell them how you want to be done. But you know, if you watch closely, there's more science that, or in fact, many, many people that you didn't think about run companies this way. there was a very good tweet by Ned Friedman, the former GitHub CEO, where he said something to the effect of, you got to micromanage. That's the only way. And I think that is the most important part for like building a team, that you have your way, like A or B, pick whatever, like it's fine, both work, but then make everybody work on this way.
It reminds me of something that I read recently about Brian Chesky, the Airbnb CEO, where he kind of came out in support of micromanaging to an extent, where he referred
very
to himself
much
as like 100%. The editor. And yes. And that was like an interesting tipping point, I think, in the conversation, where it's like, oh, okay, maybe actually this is okay. And we don't have to think about the company leader as being as hands-off as possible. I'd like to zoom in on that idea by talking about how you collaborate with Stefan, the design engineer. Can you talk a little bit about how you explore new ideas with him?
I think I talked about Pep Guardiola being a pain in the ass to work with. I know myself, I'm an incredible pain in the ass to work with. It is a very specific workflow that I like, where there is a very, very short phase. Short can literally mean 10 minutes, sometimes like, you know, half a day, where we just agree on the very basics. You know, it can be a gray box prototype, like a gray box mockup, just layout, where do things go. It can be a little bit more high fidelity, but like overall it's, you know, whatever you can get done in half a day, that is the fidelity. Then, you know, based off all the trust and all the collaboration we've had in the past, you know, he will go on for, let's say, 3 days to 2 weeks, depends on the product or the project. You know, just do his thing, then come back. And from that point onwards, it is incredibly iterative and very, very fast-paced feedback. Many people would hate to work this way, because from the very first prototype that is shared, you can expect a 20 bullet point feedback list. And this ranges from like all levels, like this all levels, copy all the way to like this interaction is not working, or kind of general confusion. And then we just do the same thing around 3 to 5 times. So goes back a couple of days, or like it depends on what it is. Goes through a feedback list. It's not a prescribed feedback list. It's like, here are my 20 things. And like he disagrees with like 7 of them or whatever. We bounce off each other and find improvements. But I think ultimately between something is, you know, mocked up to like it's published, there is really like usually around 50 to 100 pieces of feedback. Most people would never want this much feedback. They would much rather get a, you know, pat on their back and be told how great they've done, and move on and be happy ever after, and like maybe get like 2 little bits of critical feedback. But that's also why most work looks the way it looks and behaves the way it behaves.
And for what it's worth, the process is reflected in the product itself. Like, it's clear you sweat the details. Maybe you could even talk a little bit about how you think about the right level of investment into these finer details and more broadly craft of the product for a company who is still a startup. Like, you're still early on. So how do you make sure that you are reaching the bar that you're setting while not pushing that too far and getting like bogged down in the finer details?
It's incredibly hard. If you take 1 or 2 things away, like 1 or 2 details away, it does really make a difference. If you take all of them away, you are left with nothing anymore. You know, there is reasons why some of the most successful designers, you know, like Dieter Rams or the Eames, why they talk so heavily about details. And I think, so like the truth is certainly not polar in this case. Like it's somewhere in the middle that you want to find. And I think it's about your appetite. Ultimately, we do those details mostly because of who we are. I think it's just, we just appreciate those details in other products. We geek out on them. And I think we just want to like bring a little bit more of that into the world, which is, I think, something that, I guess, products that don't have any detail is also because the founder or the kind of the main designers, because they're not expressing themselves through the product. Because if you do, if it actually is like personal to you, then you kind of want to express yourself. You want to put a little bit of you into this product. And then details are like just a logical consequence. Yet again, like I think we talked about the maturing process. I don't think we will do less details. I think we'll just be like a little bit more ruthless and like do them in the important bits. But honestly, like every time we edit those finer details, it was always appreciated. One of my still very favorite, it's actually the first detail to ever exist, is always on a landing page. It's in the bottom left. There is a designed by the beach statement. Mm-hmm. And there is a wave inside of this thing. And I've always been so proud of it. We always keep it. And it's like, does it have a point? No, like some people even ask us if the beach is an agency. So like it clearly is also a bit stupid, but I think it's like, it's a little bit how you communicate. You know, like you can talk a lot about something or you can add that detail.
It's cool to hear you talk about this idea of the product being an expression of who you are, because I think that that is coming through in a way that I haven't even really seen before with a startup. And I even had a tweet, I mean, like months ago, about your pricing page, where it's like a letter that is coming from you. It has your face and your name on it. And it's working. Like, that is definitely something that I'm experiencing as a user. And I think a lot of other companies are going to look at that as a playbook and even an example of how far you can push this idea of really making a product personable and part of the identity of who is actually behind it.
I think it's interesting where I've noticed that every company is an expression of the founder, and like in ways that, you know, are sometimes conscious, sometimes unconscious. I think for us, yes, there is a lot of conscious expressions. You talked about the sort of high production value launch videos. Are they worth it? No, 100% not. There is no way in which you can make the math where the result is, this is worth it. So clearly, if it's not worth it and we still do it, there has to be some immaterial value to it. And I think that is, you know, that is part of the expression. Most things that work exceptionally well inside a company and those things that work exceptionally poorly inside a company, you know, I believe you can always draw them back to the dominant founder. So there is a certain insecurity that creates a company that waits to relaunch for so many years. There is a certain type of like insufficiency, like you just think you are not enough. And because you think that, you don't put out your product faster. Because if you are like fully self-confident, like, you know, you would just put it out. Like, there is people who put out things after 2 days of work. I would never do this. It's just not who I am. It's like, it doesn't fit sort of my traits and my personality and my flaws and all of that. And then on the other side, you know, people ask me like how to launch, broadly speaking. And I think now I can give it in one or two sentences. Actually, it's two steps. Do something worth sharing and then ask your friends to kickstart. That's all I can give as advice. So it can be a cool website, it can be a cool product. And then in our case, you know, we supplement with press, we supplement with a launch video. We have a very artsy website that kind of makes a point about who we are. But again, all of this is because like there is things inside of me that lead to this, where like, you know, it's always about compensating something that you're missing or something that you have too much of.
I appreciate the vulnerability. You talked about like the immaterial value of these videos. You talked about like the website making a point about who you are. Can you go a little bit deeper about that? Like, in what ways is the way that you've thought about telling the story on the website a representation of who you are as a founder and how much you care about the product?
The inspiration for the website is the most simple, but still personal there is. I was on a run. I saw the sunset. I made the connection between how intuitive the sky is to make you feel a certain time. So like if I show you a picture of a sky, you know what time it is. And I think that was a spark. That was like, I saw this gradient. Like, you know, everybody talked about like, you know, artificial gradients, but like I saw this gradient in front of my eyes on a mountain. I was like, wow, like you couldn't like, I mean, try to recreate this in Figma. You would take a lot of time for what the earth is just presenting you out of nothing. And like the gradient will never be the same. It will tomorrow it's going to be a bit different. And I think that was a very personal thing that I wanted to express a lot more artsy than it had to be. And I know that people appreciate it. Like, not everybody. Many people think it's a completely overblown, useless website. We got hate for it, whatever. So it's all okay.
Hey guys, real quick, if you know me, then you know I love products. So I want to take just 30 seconds to tell you about three of my favorites. Now, anytime that I'm designing and building a website, you better believe that I'm going to use Framer. I made the switch recently and I'm never going back. Now, once it's time to animate my designs and showcase my work, that's when I'm gonna use Jitter. It's like Figma, only for motion design. And every step of the way, I'm gonna be using Raycast constantly. It's the cornerstone of how I use my computer and the way that I stay in flow while I work. Now, I hand selected Framer, Raycast, and Jitter to partner with me so that I could do these interviews full time. So if you want to show them some love, it would mean a lot. Okay, now on to the rest of the episode. It's not that hard, I think, if you have the budget and you have the time to create something that, you know, Design Twitter loves, gets a bunch of retweets, you have this really beautiful website. It's going to take time, but like it's totally doable. I think it's so much harder to create something that is inherently polarizing, where you have this group of people where they absolutely love what you have done. And then there's other people where there's like, no, that does not resonate at all. And I think probably the only way to do that is to like create something that is deeply personal and designed from the core of like who you are.
There is one venture fund starting with an A, not in Dresden, and you know, very successful. Who they said that they're worried that I'm too much of an artist to, you know, turn this into a successful business. And whether they are right or wrong is still out. The jury is still out on that. I think we have to find out in the next episode. But yeah, it is true. Like, you know, actually, I read the other day, two days ago, I read a tweet where someone said we are trying too hard. But and I think we are trying very hard. But, you know, on the other hand, I would also prefer to be known as the guy who tried a lot than the guy who was like too cool to try.
Yeah, I love that. Maybe someone is listening and they're like, okay, it's very clear that Dennis is personal in the way he designs. The things he puts out are almost like equal part creative expression and a piece of who he is. And maybe they don't feel that. So perhaps in an attempt to clarify what that looks like, do you have a sense for what the opposite looks like? Like, what does it look like to not be personal in the way that you design?
I always think about the idea that too much advice cancels down to zero. If you get too much advice, you are in the same spot. You still don't know what to do. Let's say I see a new shoe that I like, and my razor, Dennis's razor, has become that if I ask anyone for their opinion on the shoe, I won't buy it. It's not good enough. And that's what we are doing for design. How many people do you think we showed the website before releasing it? It's a number that approaches zero. Like, until, like, our investor...
Oh, that's crazy.
Like, Peter, who's our investor, who I'm very, very close with, very close, has not seen the website until release. And people in the team have not seen the website until I needed their direct help on the website. I personally, as a designer, have these moments only once or twice a year, at best, where I see something, I know the concept, and I know it's just so good, I don't need any advice. So most often I need advice because I'm not sure enough. But for the website, I had it in my head like very clearly. Like I knew exactly how it needs to behave. And then it was trivial. It was trivial to execute.
Let's talk about the execution piece then, because you said that you're pretty good at picking designers. What are you looking for when choosing someone to collaborate with?
It's very hard to put in words, but I can look at a portfolio for 5 seconds and know. Just show me one screen, one thing you did. And then it boils down to the designs. You just look in a screen or like in a website, in a product, in anything they've done. You just look for that, like for two or three details. Where have they truly done something that they wouldn't have had to do? What, no one asked them to do this, and they did it because they thought it would add a little bit more soul to the thing they were designing. The moment you find someone that did that once or twice or three times across different projects, it's a very high likelihood that they will succeed. Another way I think that is a bit different, but kind of the same. This is more useful for like the design engineering sort of more versatile person that is not just inside Figma. What have they done in the free time where the quality is unreasonably high given the time investment? And I think back in the days when Stefan joined us, it was very clear he had built two projects where the quality of execution was truly a lot higher than most VC-backed companies. And it was just him in his free time toying around building products for no purpose other than, you know, enjoyment and like for the process, truly. And so the moment you see just one thing someone did that is interesting to play with, it's usually like a hit. For example, Xavier, who we did the website with, has a project which is incredible. Basically, you can, you know, give permissions to your camera, you can hold up your hand, and you can control your computer with your hands. Of course, very basic. It's not like you can actually, you know, write and like do all those interactions, but it doesn't matter. It's a proof of concept. It's like it shows that I should be able with my hands to like swipe you away or like control, like zoom in, zoom out. That's what he prototyped. And when I saw it, I was so impressed. I showed it to like the barista in the cafe I was sitting at. I was just like, can you imagine that? The moment you find this one thing, it's over. Like it's a done deal. From Xavier specifically. And until we already sort of agreed to work to do this together, I haven't seen like a real website from him. Like something that he did that is like sort of website or like kind of storytelling. He did a lot of things, but I haven't seen them. The decision was purely based off the one project he did where I was like, this is unreasonable. Like, why did you do this? There's so much thought, so much drive, so much like passion, so much skill. There's like so many things that go into having done this. I'm like, that's why I say it's easy.
It's cool to hear you say that because it reminds me of something I read recently that was talking about this idea that it's getting more difficult to tell junior and senior portfolios apart because the designs have become a little bit more standardized. We know what good looks like. It's not that hard to copy good. There's a lot of open source products. We have a lot of familiarity and general acceptance on like which patterns work and which ones to build our designs around. And so you used this word soul, and that really stood out to me. It's like, how do I add soul to the way that I'm presenting myself? I'm going to be thinking a lot about that.
The fact that it's hard to differentiate is 100% clear. I like this word eclectic. For me, the meaning is sort of someone that draws inspiration from many different fields. I think many of the people who are really good with design and engineering draw a ton of inspiration from gaming. Not the leaderboard, not this type of stuff. That has been commoditized, that has been standardized. But like, there is interaction patterns inside games that some of the really good designers and engineers use, because games are super interesting products from, because they, in some way, they have more leeway because you pay for it. And so you commit to use it a little bit more. But there is one place. I think about brand and branding. And for that, we draw, I would say, like 80 to 90% from high fashion brands. You know, I spent a lot of time last year in Paris, and it was amazing. I mean, the whole shout out to the whole MO crew. I had the luck, the fortune to like work a few days out of their office a couple of times in the last 2-3 years. And it's always inspiring. But in the broader Paris context, it makes sense why something like this comes out of Paris. You're actually surrounded by so much beauty, you know, the top 5 leading products. It's always the same visual aesthetic that they use. Why try to reinvent something when you can just take something that's pretty good and like it will work? It like increases your odds. So I think startups are all about increasing the odds. So you did well, but from a more philosophical perspective. It would be beautiful to like, you know, combine 2 things that no one ever combined. I think no one ever made a productivity app this personal. And this, I think honestly, like also this fashionable. I think, you know, this is where I was not sure to do it, but like the pants in the video.
You know, ask you about the pants, yeah.
You know, we embroidered, like it's actually like, I mean, the logo embroidered, I mean, this is like actually a reference. It's not even, like it's nearly stealing from the Spanish high fashion brand called Louis Vuitton. They kind of did that. We just ripped it. I think it's fine because like, you know, if I were to speak to the, you know, chief designer of Louis Vuitton, I think they would understand that it's not competitive at all. You know, like we all make fashion. Like it's different if Louis V would do the same.
Before I let you go, I have a question that I like to ask people, and I'm particularly interested in your answer, which is, what's something that you believe about design that you think a lot of other designers might disagree with?
So from my own experience, you can only have really 2 types of design teams. You can have incredibly small design teams. So oftentimes probably just 1 per platform if you have multiple. If not, oftentimes 1 can be sufficient. Or you could do it like Arc or Browser Company. I think they have a lot of designers, a lot of design engineers, a lot of prototyping people, etc. So like a lot of people that don't have to contribute to like, you know, production, like immediately like make this button, whatever. So I think most companies are best served with the first approach, which also in consequence means that probably most companies have 3 to 5x too many designers. So they maybe should only have 20 to like 30% of the amount of designers they have. I think it like in a company I used to work for, it was actually at some point put to an extreme. Like this app only had like give or take 30 screens, but they were like at some point 50 people working in design. So that alone should already tell you that something is really severely going wrong. I mean, it's the same effect that happens across companies of bigger size usually, like a specialization. And then you specialize the specialty. So you are already responsible for only like a small part of the app, but then you also get in a researcher. And then you maybe even like some companies are so big, they have like then dedicated writers for those apps. And so like suddenly you have to go through so many loops to get anything done, when I think most companies, and this goes back to, you know, what Brian Chesky said about being the editor, how I reference Pep Guardiola, you need singular vision, because I think otherwise it is very, very challenging to be consistent. Consistency is, I'm not sure if it is achievable. If it is, it's very difficult when you have 3, 4, 5 people cooking. When you have 1 person cooking a big chunk of your product, you are near guaranteed, if they are good, you're near guaranteed for things to be consistent. Many companies have a ratio, right? They have a target ratio of engineer to designer. And that ratio, usually the numbers I see is like at the lowest end, even 2 to 1, 2 engineers to 1 designer. And then on the highest end, like for the really non-design focused companies, 10 to 1. So like in that realm, for the 10 to 1 companies are usually the Amazons of the world. But I think many companies, even the design-driven ones, can easily handle a 10 to 1.
Maybe we can end by giving you an opportunity to share your singular vision for where Amy and this product can go. And what's something that has you really excited when you look into the future?
I was mesmerized by some new updates on the Tesla full self-driving. It's called version 12.3 supervised. Anyways, it has like some behavior where I'm like, this is crazy. For example, there's a woman which looks like she may be entering the street to cross, but in fact she waves, like she has like a hand sign of like, no, I'm going into this parked car. But the hand sign is not very like explicit. And the Tesla understood and kept driving because of this hand sign. And like there is more examples like this where I was like, wow, this is actually impressive. Hmm. If I think about what excites me the most for Amy's future and the product is, I think this idea of like full self-driving. But I think we have to build up an understanding so deep about your relationships, about how you write, how you think, what you know, and then pass that on. We inform you what we've done, what we're about to do. We wait for your approval. Like, you know, we make it super easy. You press whatever one button and like a bunch of actions get triggered that you've reviewed. And I think that would be amazing because I think ultimately the impact that we can have on people is just by saving them as much time as possible. Because you can only create value in three ways. You can help people have more sex. Then you can help people make money, save money. And then we are in the business of like saving people time because there is a class of people that value time more than money and more than anything else. So yeah, I think only if we really save you an hour, 2 hours a day, I think then we're like bound to be incredibly successful and incredibly relevant for people. And that is something I'm really inspired by because I think it really like changes the interaction patterns. It also like, you know, and there is this interesting point that everybody now thinks about what is the next big thing. Is it the browser or is it a pin? Like, is it an always on device like that hangs around your neck? It's so interesting. But then I think most of these tools, it's all about your relationship to people. And like the products we are building, they don't seem like it. I admit that. But they are fundamentally just about your relationship to people in different ways. And I think I would love to lean in more onto that. I think that is something we have by no means unlocked. I think we have good ideas how to do it. And I think we have, again, I think, you know, I talked about it's about earning the right to be something or to do something as a product. And I think now this is a good example. We've been very patient. We've been iterating, not jumping into it because we know from past experiences, this time it will be too early. Like, let's do step 1, 2, 3, and then we can do 4. And I think we will. And I think that would be very exciting. So anyways, TLDR, too long didn't listen, make your to-do email and meeting experience as automatic as possible.
Well, if you're listening to this and you haven't used it yet, definitely check out amy.so. Even just to see the website, like, it's fantastic, but I'm a regular, you know, premium user of the product. It's really, really special. So Dennis, thank you so much for taking the time to talk today. It's been insightful and really unique to hear like how you think about this and what your journey has been like. And I'm excited to see where you go from here.
Thanks so much, Rid.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, each week I send an email to over 10,000 designers with featured resources and key insights that you can use to take a leap forward in your career. Head to dive.club/email if you want to sign up. I'll see you next week.